This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
Here begins the account of the wonders of Ireland by Giraldus Cambrensis to Henry II, illustrious King of England. It pleased your excellency, invincible King of the English, Duke of Normandy, Count of Anjou and Aquitaine, to send me from your court to Ireland. And there, when I had seen many things not found in other countries and entirely unknown, and at the same time worthy of some wonder because of their novelty, I began to examine everything carefully. What was the position of the country? What was its nature? What was the origin of the race? What were its customs? What new things and what secret things, not in accordance with her usual course, had nature hidden away in the farthest western lands?
Gerard of Wales was born about 1146 in Cambria. He produced the first known map of Ireland, or the one that we're most familiar with.
How old would that map actually be, Elizabeth?
That map dates to the late 12th century, probably early 13th century, roughly about 1200, 1224, thereabouts.
And it's part of a book as such.
Gerard produced an account of his visits to Ireland. He came about three or four times, and on his visits he recorded what he saw of Ireland and the Irish, and he explains that he recorded his memoirs or his journey without reference to any previously recorded texts.
I am aware that I shall describe some things that will seem to the reader to be either impossible or ridiculous, but I protest solemnly that I have put down nothing in this book, the truth of which I have not found out either by the testimony of my own eyes or that of reliable men found worthy of credence and coming from the districts in which the events took place.
Ireland itself and the picture of it, because I think it's probably fairer to call it a picture than a map, it really is just an oblong shape.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what the shape you could best describe it as, but it's probably like a bone, a dog's bone, if that's not too crude a way of putting it. And there are four rivers, there are a few cities, and most of the northern part of the country has nothing on it. It's, in fact, it's totally blank. Giraldus called it a topography, but it certainly couldn't be called a topography in any sense that we understand the word topography. There are no inland features depicted other than a rough depiction of rivers. There are no mountains. You don't get an idea of the value of the land or the usage to which it was put. The map itself is done without any reference to, say, what would be no in current usage is, say, longitude and latitude. There isn't even a title on the map. So it's quite intriguing from a map-making perspective.
Ireland, the largest island beyond Britain, is situated in the Western Ocean, about one short day's sailing from Wales. But between Ulster and Galloway in Scotland, the sea narrows to half that distance. Nevertheless, from either side, the promontories of the other can be fairly well seen and distinguished on a fine day. This farthest island of the West has Spain parallel to it, at a distance of three ordinary days' sailing, Greater Britain on the east, and only the ocean on the west.
It's amazing when you look at it, Sean, you'll see that the centre of the world is actually Rome. Giraldus was a cleric, and as such, his world view, I suppose, was that Rome was the centre of the world as he knew it. So the orientation of the map is with Rome at the very top, and the depiction of it would really cover half of Ireland. And even Constantinople has been drawn to come in under Rome. So the centre of the universe for Giraldus was Rome.
What cities and what rivers are detailed on this Giraldus Cambrensis or Gerald of Wales map?
Well, the largest one that we can see is the Shannon River. Then we have Áin Liffey, which is the River Liffey.
Would he have got that Irish name from somebody here? Or how would he
Well, we believe
that?
He visited Dublin, and I understand that he may have travelled by boat from Waterford to Dublin, and I would imagine that he heard the name Áin Liffey probably from native Irish speakers, or this was the name of the river in common parlance of the time. You also see that the Slaney River is depicted, as well as the Shore, and then the cities that will be associated with the various rivers. Then you have Dublin, you have Wexford, you have Waterford, and you have Limerick. These would be the main cities of the day on the navigation routes that he would have used.
The Shannon, synonymous, rightly holds the chief place among all the rivers of Ireland, whether old or new, both on account of the magnificence of its size and its long meanderings, and its abundance of fish. It rises in a certain large and beautiful lake that divides Connacht from Munster, and sends two arms, so to speak, in opposite directions of the world. Of old, the country was divided into five almost equal parts, namely Ulster, Connacht, Leinster, and two Munsters, north and south.
The greatest detail quite definitely being in the southeastern and southern part of the country. That reflects his interest in the country and how he would have come here, I presume.
It does, and if you bear in mind that he came with the Norman invading forces, their points of entry would have been primarily the Waterford-Wexford areas, as well as Dublin, but as you say, the southeast was particularly well covered by him. His knowledge of the area seems to have been primarily maritime, in other words, the rivers and via the sea. That there is no evidence that he covered the inland routes very much, if at all, because as we can see when we look at the map, it's the areas inland are blank. We have no record of mountains. If he had travelled from Waterford to Dublin, we would have a record of, for example, the you'd imagine you would have seen the Wicklow Mountains, even if it were raining or a very foggy day, but there is no evidence of that.
Who would have used this type of map?
It seems to me that the map is really a record of Giraldus's own journey. So in my view, the map is more an autobiographical expression than a map for navigational purposes, a map for finding your way around anywhere other than Giraldus's head. It's a record of his journeys, his inner travels, and some of his physical travels as well.
I have thought it worthwhile to give some account of such things as are marvellous in themselves. For just as the marvels of the East have through the work of certain authors come to the light of public notice, so the marvels of the West, which, so far, have remained hidden away and almost unknown, may eventually find in me one to make them known even in these later days.
This 16th century map that we're looking at now, Elizabeth, clearly later than the Cambrensis, but the information that was used to compile the map, ironically, goes back way, way earlier than Cambrensis.
Yes, this shown is a Waldseemüller map. It's roughly about 1513. And what we're looking at is an outline of Ireland. And as you can see, what's depicted are mainly the ports. There is a rough delineation of the River Nore and the Barrow, and a little bit of what we think may be Clew Bay as well, indented, and part of the north of Ireland and St. Patrick's Purgatory, Loch Derg, depicted as well.
Unlike the Cambrensis, there's no beautiful colour here. It's all just simple black and white.
It's been reproduced simple black and white. To put this in context, this map is more scientific, say, than the Cambrensis. It comes from a long tradition of attempting to scientifically plot a course of navigation. And within that context, the Waldseemüller is drawing from Ptolemaic Ptolemy was the geographer, mathematician, mapmaker of the first century after Christ. And what he emphasized or tried to use was a method of travel that could be done along projected lines. Now, what were used in the early 16th century and indeed slightly earlier between the Cambrensis map and this were what we know as porterlands. These were maps that were used by ship's masters, pilots, who travelled from port to port, and they recorded their routes of travel using a compass and projecting a route of travel according to certain lines of latitude and longitude. And Ptolemy tried to develop these, but his mathematical formulas were obviously limited. His texts were subsequently lost, but were translated in part by the Arabs who were settled in southern Spain and parts of the Mediterranean. So what survived were aspects of travel familiar to the Arab travelling world, the trade world, and subsequently then rediscovered around about the 1400s and translated in the 15th century into Latin for the greater part of Europe. And as part of that reworking of the Ptolemaic maps, you get this inclusion of Ireland.
Therefore, that to be grasped in general about geography should be about the clarification of map-making in accordance with historical accounts of the known parts of the earth until the present time. I, Claudius Ptolemy of Alexandria, make a beginning by the writing down of the longitudes and latitudes of long-known places, in respect of locations not having been explored, or because of scanty, uncertain, and incomplete passages of historical accounts, I use the nearest trustworthy points of reference. Thus, the north coast of the island of Hibernia lies close to the Hyperborean Sea. It has an outline as follows. Part of the Boreum Promontory, 11 of degrees, and naught of minutes longitude, 61 of degrees and naught of minutes latitude.
Yet again, the east and the southeast coasts are where we get the most detail. What sort of places are named along those coasts?
We get, for example, Swords is mentioned, Bray, Wexford, Hookhead. We get Ireland's Eye, Dublin and Drogheda, Skerries, we think, possibly Greenore, what looks like Strangford, Carrickfergus, Larne, the Loch at Larne. And then in the north we get County Antrim, we get Dunamargy, Dunseverick, Port Rush, and a bit further over you get the River Ban, which we can see fairly clearly.
Also detailed in the northern part of the country is St. Patrick's Purgatory or Loch Derg. Where would Waldseemüller have come across that type of information?
Well, he was a cleric himself. He was based at Lake Constance, around Lake Constance, and later around the Vosges area, around Loch Leman in Switzerland, which we know is around Geneva. He was a gatherer of information, recording information from various sources. So not alone was he recording new information, but he would have recorded information that had been gathered by, for example, the clerics, the religious travellers of earlier periods. And in the earlier texts, we have lots of recorded examples of St. Patrick's Purgatory being a major centre of pilgrimage, in much the same way, for example, that St. James's at Compostela would have been for pilgrims from Northern Europe and indeed France and Spain.
We reach the banks of a lake which is 4 miles round and has a rocky island in the centre, 20 steps long by 16 wide, which is called the Purgatory of St. Patrick, and is inhabited by 3 canons. Here we landed and found a little oratory with a hut and tables for the canons. In front of the church door are the 3 cabins of St. Bridget, St. Patrick and St. Columba. Behind, toward the east, is the Well of St. Patrick, a cave in which the saint is said to have slept.
Travelling around the coast then towards the western side of the country, one of the most notable aspects here is this rather unusual depiction of Clew Bay with, I don't know how many islands there are there, but there are somewhere upwards of 15, maybe 20. Is this purely oral reporting that he has then imagined?
It may be also that a number of Mediterranean ships were shipwrecked off the west coast and indeed maybe drew into that bay for shelter. Clew Bay would have provided shelter had the ships been able to get in. It is interesting, if you drive around Clew Bay, say, as the sun is setting in the west of Ireland, you notice the islands are scintillating if it's a sunny evening, and it's amazing that they're dotted so much like sheep in the bay. There are thousands, or what appear to be thousands of them, so this would appear to have been what he recorded. He would have been more than likely going on hearsay. I'm not aware that Waldseemüller himself ever travelled from his religious duties around the Swiss-German border areas to Ireland, but he would have garnered the information from travellers.
The Pleas of the Crown in the west of Ireland recounts John Lelong of Galway charging, when a ship called the Peter of Wales, laden with wine and other merchandise, was by a severe tempest wrecked in the parts of the Western Ocean near to the isle-filled Clew Bay, that some of the sailors of the ship were drowned, and some alive came to land there, and that they wished to save their goods, which, after the breaking of the ship, were thrown to land. The goods, to wit, wines, wax coffers with jewels, copper pots, and spices in barrels, were ruled to stay in the possession of Lelong.
About the 1560s, Gerard Cramer of Flanders, also known as Mercator, produced a number of different atlases, and what we're looking at is one that was reproduced a number of times, and this edition is a 1610 one.
The island of Hibernia, which follows, has been called variously Ierna, Juverna, Vernia, and, in English, Ireland. Hibernia is divided into five parts. In the east, and nearest to England, is Laganium. Conatiam is on the western edge. Ultonium is in the northern part, and Momonium is situated in the southern plain. The fifth part is called Media, and with a location at the centre of the island, is surrounded by the other four parts.
We have a depiction of Ireland. We have a clear indication as to orientation east-west. We have a little cartouche that's a little band, as it were, with the name of the country on, so we have a title now. We have a scale in the bottom left-hand corner of the map as well. We have the Irish Sea clearly depicted. We have Ireland in relation to Scotland. And you can see from this that it's not just a coastal depiction, there is also inland plotting.
And the sort of detail that's given in the inland areas, unlike the Cambrensis, which was confined to ecclesiastical sites, and in the Valsamúla that we looked at, there were just coastal towns. This has all types of detail.
It looks like it's a survey of a type. It's more topographic, even though in a very limited way. We get, for example, Loch Earn, which you would have imagined took over the whole of County Monaghan and beyond.
Yes, I'm very sad to see that there was no County Monaghan at this stage. We were under flood.
Oh, I think it was a very wet winter that year, Sean. You can see that along the Shannon, the rivers there have obviously flooded to an enormous extent. But you also get depictions of mountains. Now, this is the era when you begin to get an indication that there were mountains in various counties, but there is no idea as to scale. Similarly with the rivers, you get an idea of where the rivers may have originated from, but it isn't clear exactly to what extent the rivers did originate in those areas, or indeed what was the extent of the rivers. But there is an attempt at mapping the lie of the land. And this is then broken down into in the pages that follow. And you can see from these that there is a more clear definition of places within the various counties.
In Ultonia of the north are contained Virilia, Antrimania, and Tyrconclea. This part of Hibernia stretches to the Hyperborean Sea in the north and to Media in the south. Within its confines are the rivers Erno and Banio. Ultonia is an ample region with species of animal both wild and tame.
So this map that we're looking at now, Elizabeth, is of the province of Ulster and Connacht down below it. And even though I was worried about the size of Loch Earn flooding Monaghan out of it, it's clearly mentioned on this map and lots of details around there as well.
Yes, in fact you can see Tyrone quite clearly marked, Clogher, areas around the north of Ireland that we would be quite familiar with. It's quite interesting that Loch Ness is depicted and that areas around the coast from Carlingford are included as well, Warren Point and more inland then we have over to Connacht. Connacht is rather condensed. Obviously it hadn't been explored that much at that time. Moving further over on the map we see Beleek. We see areas that we would recognise today along the Shannon as well.
So while the shape of the coast isn't exactly what we might think of it as today, the inland detail is very close to a modern mapping situation.
Yes, we're beginning to recognise it in our contemporary sense, and the place names, obviously some of them are familiar, many of them indeed have changed, which is why we're not exactly familiar with a number of them. But it's interesting from a geographical point of view how this landscape was to change in later years. What we have here are early recordings prior to redistribution of land, prior to plantation. And it's fascinating that while we have our general outline, we also have this inner detail as well.
Another map from that period, which is out on the table in front of us here, is this Artelius. Similarly, it has the orientation north, south, east and west. We can see that it has a scale down here at the bottom. But for some reason, when we go to Ulster on this map, we don't have half as much detail. We go back to Gerald of Cambrensis and his description of Ulster.
There is a lake in Ulster of a remarkable size. It is 30 miles long and 15 miles wide. From it,
A very beautiful river called the Bann flows into the Northern Ocean. Here the fishermen complain not of a scarcity of fish, but of two great catches, and the breaking of their nets. In our time a fish was caught here, one that had come down from the lake, and not from the sea, which had the shape more or less of a salmon, and was of such size that it could not be dragged or carried as a whole. Accordingly, it was cut up and carried about through the province.
Looking at this, it's a far bigger map, and you would imagine it would carry more detail. The quotations from the Cambrensis volume include those quotes that relate to the Aran Islands.
There is an island in the sea west of Connacht, which is said to have been consecrated by St. Brendan. In this island, human corpses are not buried and do not putrefy, but are placed in the open and remain without corruption. Here men see with some wonder and recognise their grandfathers, great-grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers and a long line of ancestors.
Includes a reference to the fact that the map was made in the reign of Queen Elizabeth in 1572, and it includes another reference to St. Patrick's Purgatory.
There is a lake in Ulster which contains an island divided into two parts. One part contains a very beautiful church with a great reputation for holiness and is well worth seeing. It is distinguished above all other churches by the visitation of angels and the visible and frequent presence of local saints. But the other part of the island is stony and ugly and is abandoned to the use of evil spirits only. There are 9 pits in that part, and if anyone by any chance should venture to spend the night in any one of them, he is seized immediately by malignant spirits and is crucified all night with severe torments. They say that if a person once undergoes these torments because of a penance imposed on him, he will not have to endure the pains of hell, unless he commit some very serious sin.
Other than that, the landscape is largely blank.
Again, he has a lot of detail down in Munster and in South Leinster, down in the southeast and southern coasts. Is it quite simply the fact that because of the Norman invasions, this area was better known?
It may have been that travel was easier in the southern parts of the country, that the areas were perhaps more hospitable, that the terrain was more welcoming, that transport was easier. We know from the earlier maps that cities of the period, in fact, were quite extant in the southern and eastern parts of the country. These are the ones most recorded, and that there were a number of larger landowners in these areas who would have retained, for example, large libraries, who would have welcomed map makers and who would have facilitated, say, the development of trade.
And these 16th century maps, they're a crossover period. They're the end of one period and the beginning of something else.
Yes, this is the cusp, as it were, of the expansion of map making, the known world, which was at this stage as far as America and Asia. We see the use of the compass on this particular map and the use of English miles to depict the map according to a type of scale. We know that from about this period, from the Elizabethan period, that exploration began to be not just peripheral along the coast, but allied with trade interests and general colonial interests, and Ireland being in the way of that. What we see or begin to see is more of an interest in interior detail, in the lie of the land, in the use of that land, in who owned that land, what the religious denomination of the landowners were, and to what use the raw materials of that land could be put, for example, turf, for example, timber. So from here, then, I think what we begin to see is more of an interest in plantation, redistribution of land, controlling areas of strategic importance, and billeting of military personnel.
So military and plantation maps are our next chapter.
I think so, and we'll be looking at a number of them. We have quite a good selection in the National Library, and they portray different aspects of the whole colonial and colonising map-making eras.